Hello, welcome to Spotlight.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
This evening we have a chat with local historian and author John Manley about his amazing new book Pleasure Domes and Picture Palaces. Hear how you'll find Men of the World at the Peel Centenary Centre next week. It's the latest production from drama group The Legion Players. And speak with local marine biologist Rowan Henthorne, who features in a new documentary film which receives its premiere in London this very evening. Remember, do get in touch with any creative artistic endeavours you might be involved in, planning, hoping to create, or would really like to put in that spotlight. Poetic, theatrical, musical, literary, ceramic, sculpted, drag, film, mime, social media. The list goes on, we know. Spotlight at maxradio.com, Howard Kane at maxradio.com, either, both. Just do it, though. If I don't hear from you, we can't feed you, and I'd like to. Now, it seems amazing for somewhere which has been closely linked with entertainment for well over 100 years now, but no one's ever really tried to document the history of seaside entertainment on the Isle of Man to any comprehensive degree, at least until now, that is. Pleasure Domes and Picture Palaces is local historian and author John Manley's magnum opus, being as it is a history of seaside entertainment on the Isle of Man from start to finish. Lavishly illustrated with copious amounts of photographs and illustrations, it must surely be the most comprehensive book of its kind available. John told me he was surprised such a work hadn't been done before. I don't think I was.
I was quite surprised to find that nobody had written the story of the Isle of Man's great period of entertainment, particularly the 19th century.
And I was thinking that when is or when would you classify as its sort of its heyday?
Undoubtedly, the 1890s onwards into the mid 20th century. Island tourism was at its peak, and the island entrepreneurs had to cater for the mass tourism that was arriving on Manx shores every summer.
And so how far back could you go? Because I was just looking at the early parts there, and it's certainly going back. We have references to the mid-19th century and even earlier than that, late 18th century. Was there much happening in what we'd call entertainment then on the island?
No, the beginning of the book traces the island's dearth of entertainment in the 16th, 17th centuries. Literally, Manx people at that time entertained themselves to the music of the fiddle. They actually danced to the music of the fiddle, but there was no structured, organised entertainment. The only entertainment of that kind was at Castle Rushen, where the Lords of Man, the Earls of Derby, could afford to attract touring players from the United Kingdom and invite their noble friends to come and watch a performance at Castle Rushen.
So when did the sort of change start to happen into an area where what we now know as sort of, you know, mass entertainment started to take place?
Several changes started to happen on the Isle of Man around the turn of the 19th century. The Isle of Man was known throughout the British Isles as a refuge for debtors in Great Britain. They fled to the Isle of Man to avoid prosecution. Half-pay officers also fled to the Isle of Man from Britain for other reasons. They were laid off at the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the American conflicts, and they came to reside on the Isle of Man for its economic benefits. There was also a great fad from the mid-18th century onwards for sea bathing throughout Britain. The Isle of Man became one of the sea bathing resorts of Great Britain, and there were several groups of people therefore descending on the Isle of Man. And all these new immigrants with their various wealths attracted camp followers like entertainers. And those are the first group of professional entertainers that we saw on the island. but they were mainly itinerant. They would come and go. There were no full-time professional theatres. There were no full-time professional performers on the island.
So these were literally the wandering minstrels, as it were?
Literally, that's exactly what they were. And they would come to the Isle of Man, perform for a short period, especially during the summer months when tourism would be at its height. And then they would go back and tour around various cities in England.
Now, what about some of the venues then? Because I suppose, again, now we are familiar with some places which have been there a long time. We're thinking, obviously, Villa Marina, famously, Gaiety Theatre. Are there others which are now long gone, which used to be right at the sort of forefront of the entertainment industry?
Yes, there certainly were. Around the turn of the 19th century, there were actually many theatres in Douglas, and they are mentioned in the book with various names, but it's very hard for a historian to keep a proper track of them because the newspapers recorded scant details and the theatres were very temporary. They would often pop up with the same names and they wouldn't last for long. There wasn't, at the turn of the 19th century, there wasn't the mass number of tourists to make full-time theatres on the island worthwhile. So they all faded away, and no serious professional theatres on the island originated until the mid-19th century. The most famous being the Theatre Royal in what was then Wellington Street, previously known as Preaching House Lane and Factory Lane. That was opened by a Nottingham man, John Moseley, who had his own theatres in England. And he opened the Theatre Royal there in Wellington Street, and it became very successful. By the mid-19th century, the island was regularly attracting 50, 60, 70,000 tourists in the summer, and the Theatre Royal put on some excellent shows for the visiting masses.
So the Gaiety Theatre we know and love and is still widely used, of course, today, is that a relative newcomer?
It's a very relative newcomer. In 1893, the forerunner to the Gaiety Theatre, or today's Gaiety Theatre, was the Pavilion Theatre on the same site, which transformed into the Gaiety Theatre as we know it today in 1900, when the site was acquired by a well-known Manx entertainment company called the Palace and Derby Castle Company.
And the Derby Castle again, and that's a name which people of a certain age will remember, maybe not so much younger generations coming through now, but the Derby Castle again was once a famed venue.
Yes, and that didn't come onto the scene until as late as 1887, when a respected High Bailiff of Peel, Mr. Alfred Nelson Lawton, turned the former private residence into the Derby Castle Entertainment Centre. The success of the Derby Castle quickly led to a scutch of competitors. For example, around the same time, the Falcon Cliff, which had also been a private residence, was converted into a hotel and very soon thereafter a pleasure resort. This quickly attracted the attention of Mr. John Brown, who was the leading entrepreneur of his day, and he quickly formed a Manx syndicate when the Castle Mona Hotel, as it was then, was put on the open market in the 1880s. Mr. Brown saw the possibility of the Castle Mona becoming a further competitor to the Falcon Cliff and the Derby Castle, and he believed that there wasn't enough business to cater for these expanding businesses. In 1898, therefore, Mr. Brown successfully formed a merger of all the four main centres of attraction in Douglas, which were the Derby Castle, the Falcon Cliff, the Pavilion Theatre, and the Palace, which had been formed by the Manx Syndicate a few years earlier.
Wow, so a bit of a sort of mega conglomerate, as it were.
The Palace and Derby Castle Company became a mega conglomerate and wanted the business of the visiting hordes for itself. And it was very successful thereafter. It maintained the main Douglas entertainment sites well into the 20th century.
And of course, we're talking today in Manx Radio, and just behind us here over the hill, it was the outdoor theatre, which still exists today, little used sadly, but again, in its heyday, that certainly was used well into the 20th century, to the best of my knowledge.
Yes, the Douglas Head area was a prime attraction during the 19th century. As you quite rightly say, the remains of the old theatre stage, well, it was a later theatre stage comprised of concrete, actually. There were more primitive theatres on the site before that, but the base of the theatre still remains on Douglas Head. But Douglas Head had a fantastic array of attractions in the 19th century and into the earlier 20th century. There were minstrel shows. There was the Warwick Tower, which had a fantastic revolving platform that rose 200 feet into the air.
Some pictures of that, yes, went right up. It was up behind us here somewhere. And that must have been spectacular.
It was spectacular, but sadly burnt down a few years after its erection. The Douglas Head Hotel, of course, became a concert room in its own right. And there were various stalls and attractions all over Douglas Head. It was a main site of attraction for visitors.
It was terrific then, and we can't finish our chat with also about something that Maurice Powell and I have spoken about sort of through the 40s and 50s down at the Villa when all the big dance bands have come, and I've seen again that there might be some in the book here, but I've seen pictures before of people like Roy Fox and Joe Loss and people over, and these dance floors absolutely rammed with dancers, literally thousands of people.
Yes, in the peak year of 1913, over 600,000 visitors annually travelled to the summer in the Isle of Man. And even, as you quite rightly say, in the middle of the 20th century, there were still 500,000 visitors annually travelling to the island. And the main centres of attraction then had become the Palace and the Villa Marina, of course.
Have you got any favourites after all the research? Because clearly huge amounts of research go into these sort of books. Pleasure Domes and Picture Palaces and the long covering exit, almost 150, 200 years almost, if you go back to the late 18th century. But any sort of favourite period or favourite artists or stories that you've come across during the research for the book?
Yes, my own favourite artist is Miss Vesta Tilley, who in the late 19th century... and the early 20th century was the leading female performer in Britain. In fact, she was the highest earning female in Britain. And I've researched her fees that she was paid by the Palace and Derby Castle Company. And her fees far outreached any other fees of any other performers. Even well into the mid-20th century, she was most definitely a star attraction. And her life history is fascinating. She rose from a birth in the Midlands of England into poverty, and it literally is a rags-to-riches story.
Yeah, the Taylor Swift of her day.
Literally the Taylor Swift of her day and the pulling power of Taylor Swift of her day.
It's a wonderful achievement, an awful lot of work, a fascinating read, and some amazing photos. If you like exploring the island's past, you will love it. It's widely available via Bridge Bookshop, the Manx Museum, House of Mananan, and the Mostly Manx store in Douglas, and is well worth your attention.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
From history to drama, and if you like good northern humour, observational comedy at its best, or perhaps just a fan of the playwright John Godber, then listen up. Godber has a great resonance with the Isle of Man, of course, being of good northern stock and having previously written for TV series like Brookside, just across the way in Liverpool there. Next week, the Legion Players will stage a performance of his play Men of the World, which explores the trials and tribulations of the average working man and woman who are past their first flush of youth through the eyes of three coach drivers. It is very funny, and I'm not saying that just because I'm in it. The Legion Players' Steph Gray says the group is no stranger to his work.
He is the worst driver we have ever been with.
I mean, we were sat there for nearly 3 hours, and not once did he offer to put the air conditioning on.
There were people on that coach gasping for their breath.
I had hoped that the trip would be relaxing, but frankly, when you're flying by the Rhine gasping for your breath, it's not easy to relax. We've had quite a year as it is.
Oh, just leave it, Molly, because the whole trip is a nightmare.
I did think we might come again, but if we do, we'll not come with Larry.
He's a great observational writer, and we've done, obviously, Godber's before, been on the island. You did April in Paris, and you've done...
Well, I think Bouncers has been on
Bouncers
before,
some of
those, and Shakers, those ones.
Yeah, so it's three characters playing multiple characters. I think, I mean, not caricatures, definitely not caricatures, because there's definitely layers to each of the characters, and... the way he writes just gives you little insights into sometimes the sadness and the pathos and the frustration and disappointment in their lives. So, but it's always done in a very comic way as well.
And it's very observational, very northern, sort of gritty, earthy humour, lots of pathos and such like.
It is, but it's typical Godber. That's what he does best. It's just observes and then writes.
Just a three-hander, so there's nowhere to hide in these sort of things in many ways.
Oh, it's very exposed. And lots and lots of lines to learn, as you are aware, Howard.
Yes, and there's lots of one-liners, which is often the case.
Yeah, but it's a good challenge, and Peel Centenary Centre is a lovely theatre to do it in. I mean, the Legion Players work in association with Peel Centenary, which is great. We get to do theatre there, both in the main theatre and in the Athol Room. And it's, as I said, it's a lovely little venue. And yes, on the 10th and the 11th of May, which is a week on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And being done, as you say, under the Legion Players, which, of course, I think one of the oldest, if not the oldest, drama group still in existence on the Isle of Man.
It is. It's quite old now. It's been going back until 1932. We're a very small society, but like a lot of societies now, we join forces with other actors to do things in different ways as well. So very collaborative. It's always a very collaborative approach.
And definitely you've done some as well, I know, which have been very popular, where you've done it almost in a sort of cabaret setting, where you've been in the Athol Room there and you've done some monologues.
We do theatre suppers. It's very much about trying to get theatre in a different style and do it in a different venue, maybe for people who wouldn't ordinarily come to a main theatre. And the theatre suppers seem to be very well supported and work very well. And again, it's being very, very up close and personal with the audience is very challenging as an actor, as you know. You haven't got the stage, you haven't got the proscenium arch to hide behind, you haven't got the bright lights either.
This one, however, will be across the way in the actual sort of main theatre in the Centenary Centre.
It is, yes. It's a two-actor. So, and hopefully it should be a laugh. I think that's the main thing. It's, giving everybody a good night out and a bit of a belly laugh as well.
Which is the most important thing. Obviously not entirely on your own. As you say, it's a small sort of tight-knit little group. It's not a big society like some of the big musical societies, but you have had help with direction and such like.
Yes, Helen Clark, very valiantly, I tapped her on the shoulder and said, would she mind directing? I did suggest co-directing, but actually she'd done it all. So yes, it always is. And you know, we'll pull people in to help us backstage and do the set dressing. And Peel Centenary staff are excellent in terms of lighting and set for us as well. So it's supposed to be fun for us, because obviously it's a hobby, but it's also supposed to be fun for the audience, and hopefully they'll have a good night out and a laugh as well.
I hope so. It is a very funny play, and if you like Godber, if you like northern humour, then we'll certainly give it our best shot. And I think if we can get it right, it is very funny. There's some great characters. The observational writing is always very well done. Men of the World, John Godber. It'd be lovely if he came across to see it. We should invite him sometime, shouldn't we? He can't live that far away, can he?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Just just remind us of the date again and how people can get tickets.
It's on Friday the 10th and Saturday the 11th of May, and Peel Centenary Centre has its ticketing system online. The posters will be going up, and tickets are also available at Celtic Gold.
No, it's no use. I've had enough of all of you. You can't speak to anyone on the trip without them going on about their waterworks or when they last had bowel surgery.
Molly!
I had thought we might meet someone and have some discussion about the German Romantics and Wagner. But frankly, we've been hard pushed to get past talking about Arthur Scargill and Marks and Spencer's Remnants and the language. I'm not a prude, but
it's great fun. But my lordy, difficult to learn. We live in hope we'll have it all in place by the first night. Come along, check it out, say hello. Should be a great, good fun night out. I assume the bar will be open. What's not to like? Tickets from the Peel Centenary Centre or Celtic Gold. As Steph says, see you there, hopefully. Finally this evening, a film premiere. But you'll have to get your skates on to get to it, as it's in London this very evening. Now, back in 2018, as you might have heard on Breakfast this morning, Ireland-based marine biologist Rowan Henthorne took part in the world's first all-female expedition, which travelled on a month-long voyage to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Very isolated, but massive, made up of huge amounts of plastic rubbish. The expedition included a filmmaker who made a documentary of the voyage and, indeed, its purpose. Tonight, the result, X Trillion, sees its premiere. The 14-strong international crew included local marine biologist Rowan Henthorne, who told Max Radio's Siobhan Fletcher more about it.
Our crew are amazing women. They're scientists, journalists, artists, filmmakers and creators.
Who are you sharing a room with?
It's the dream team. Me, Anna, Christine, Christine.
But they're not sailors.
The film is by an incredible woman called Eleanor Church, and she came out and filmed the whole time. So she had quite a task on her hands, of filming us on board this sailing boat that was on a 45-degree angle all the time, and filming all the science that we did, all the experiences that we had, the storms that we went through. And she's done it as a passion project, really. So that's why it's taken this time, because she's kind of done it on the side and done it a lot of it for free. And she's put a huge amount of effort and work into it. And it's an incredible film about the story of us crossing the ocean.
Tell me then about what you learned on the trip, because obviously this is about the scale of the plastic pollution crisis. And, you know, I think people maybe know that we find plastic in the ocean and it washes up on our shores. But sort of what perspective did it give you when you were out there?
Yeah, I think I started the trip kind of from maybe my science background, understanding the issues of plastic pollution. But it's not until you're out there and you see it that you truly understand the scale of the problem. And just that realization that we have impacted the most remote corners of the earth. So I think just learning about the scale and the challenge of the problem was really eye-opening, being out in the North Pacific. But I think probably one of the biggest things I learned was the power of collective action and community and people coming together and talking about ideas, and particularly people from different sectors. So that it wasn't 14 scientists on board. We had product designers, teachers, filmmakers, and scientists. And actually, that's where you make really exciting, you know, you find really exciting solutions to many of the challenges we face when we work together and come up with exciting solutions.
Here on the Isle of Man, will this be streaming anywhere? Where can people kind of watch it?
Yes. So really exciting that I think it's on World Ocean Day. It will be going on the Discovery Channel, which is really exciting for people to stream. But yeah, I'd love the opportunity to do a screening over here and share it, because it's really a wonderful story.
I've watched the trailer. It looks amazing. World Ocean Day is Saturday the 8th of June, and sometime after that, it should be available to watch via streaming platforms. Watch out for it. It looks great. That's about it for this week. Don't forget, if you want to hear anything again, go to maxradio.com, download the Spotlight podcast, listen where and when you want. Why not try it out whilst counting the number of potholes down your local road? See you next week. Until then, look after yourselves, and whatever you're doing, be creative about it. Cheerio.